I've puzzled a little bit on how to forget to begin the introduction to tonight's Bible study. How about this? We're going to talk about a beauty contest. Maybe we're going to choose Miss Persia tonight. How about let's build a harem? Don't like that one, huh? How about a simple oops? Oops, because eventually our sorry king from last week has sobered up. Well, the truth is, it's actually, I see that head shake, okay? He has more than sobered up, quite honestly. In fact, this isn't just a few months later. This isn't just after his hangover is gone. This is actually a number of years later. There's quite a passage of time. We're going to look at that in a minute. Because there is a passage of time, I need to review the history, one of my infamous mini-reviews. You know how long they last. Look at Esther chapter 1, verse 3. In the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants. Okay, now we established last week that Ahasuerus began his reign, it's a matter of historical record, in the year 486 B.C., the third year of his reign, then, is 486 minus 3, because this is B.C., so it's 483. See, I'm not a mathematician, but I got that. See? He removes Vashti in 483/482. We're not exactly certain of the month for that. But in 481, we do know that Ahasuerus took his 200,000-man army to the Battle of Thermopylae and lost to the Spartans. So that's another established date. And we closed last week, or just about closed, with this statement. I got it right because I copied and pasted. By the time Esther becomes the subject of chapter 2, it is 480-479 B.C., so, for just a second, look at chapter 2, verse 16, where the text says, Esther was taken unto King Ahasuerus into his house royal in the 10th month, which is the month Tebet, in the 7th year of his reign. Do you see that? This, then, is 479. The 7th year of his reign. So J.D. can go sit back down now because I got it right. J.D., I just pick on you because I love you, my friend. Our sorry king has been 3.5 to 4 years without a queen. So just imagine, he has been to the battles, he's lost, and he returns from his military campaign, and he's sitting in his palace. Now look at chapter 2, verse 1. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. That opening statement, after these things, is a reasonably common biblical expression. But it doesn't always tell us after how many things or how long a period of time. But it does tell us that there's some things that have happened in between the previous statement and then this one. After these things, that's why we reviewed those dates. Just that was really a mini review, right? It's been 4 long years, and a lot of military men have been lost. An entire navy has been sunk, lost pride, lost resources, lost national wealth. So talk about God's timing for a minute. God's timing in this case. It would appear to you and I that things are moving along quite slowly. This is so slow that this is one of those things where in the movie they wouldn't bother to portray it all. They'd simply say 4 years later at the bottom. And they are moving slowly, especially when you compare the pace at which things are moving here to the frenetic pace in which we do things in our lives. You've heard me tell you about my microwave, 20 seconds. I mean, we want things to happen fast. Go back to the movies. They condense years in movies into an hour and 20 minutes, and then 40 minutes of commercials. Not only are God's ways not our ways and God's thoughts not our thoughts, but God's timing isn't our timing either. He may not be mentioned in the book of Esther, but he is superintending all these events. It is no mistake that Ahasuerus lost. It is no mistake that Vashti's been gone for 4 years. He arranged for Vashti, if you will, to disobey the king's command, essentially just before the king could do anything about it, because he had a battle to go lose. Travel was slow in those days. There was no high-speed rail service. The king was gone all that time. Certainly, he must have at some point given some thought to his marital status while he was away. So was God preparing the king's heart for his return? Good question, isn't it? Proverbs 21:1 says, "The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord as the rivers of water. He turns it whithersoever he will." And so the king returns, and there's no one to greet him at the palace door. No wife waiting to console him for all the tremendous loss that Persia has just suffered. Might we also read from that text or get the idea that maybe he missed her? What does the text say? He remembered Vashti 4 years later and what she had done and what was decreed against her. And I find it interesting that that whole phrase is, quite honestly, rather complete. It's not leaving a lot of things that we aren't told. He remembered Vashti, number one. Number two, he remembered what she had done. And if it had stopped here, we could simply say that his remembrance was not a good one. But the last phrase, "and what was decreed against her," that could also be read to say what he decreed against her. Because he did, didn't he? He was the king. I think he missed her. And I think that in the palace intrigue of the ancient Near East and Persia, I think that his servants noticed. Because look at verse 2, chapter 2. "Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, let there be fair young virgins sought for the king. And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom," that's all 127 of them, "that they may gather together all the fair young virgins under Shushan the palace, to the house of the women, under the custody of Hagi, the king's chamberlain, keeper of the women. Let their things for purification," hang on to that word, "be given them, and let the maiden which pleaseth the king be queen instead of Vashti." And the thing pleased the king, and he did so. Now, he can't take Vashti back, because that's the rules of the Medes and Persians, and he can't change that. He did it. He can't take her back. Now, apparently, the first thing we need to notice here is that 4 years ago, when Vashti disobeyed the king, he was being advised by his seven princes. Now, it's an undisclosed number of king's servants who are ministering to him. Apparently, it's a different group of people. Makes me scratch my head and wonder, what happened to the princes? Battle planning didn't go so swell, off with their heads? Well, we don't know. But this is apparently a different group of people. We can also know that Ahasuerus wasn't looking for just any beautiful woman. He already had a harem. All the kings of the ancient Near East had them. Even Israel and Judah's kings had multiple wives.
we don't like the word. I don't like the word harem. But that's what it was.
And it's interesting. There's some ugliness in here that we're going to see toward the end, which I think is here on purpose. Just like it is when the dirt came out of King Ehud because of a dagger going in there, because sin is dirty. And there's a lot of sin here in this chapter, and it's dirty. So we can know that Ahasuerus was looking for a woman who would be his wife here. Wife number one. His queen. That one feminine soul that he could share his life with. Guys, you know exactly what I mean, don't you? That one woman that you trust your heart and your life to. That's what this king wants. In spite of his pagan, sinful lust with his harem, he still needs one woman to share his life with. The servant's recommendation was not going to be accomplished in just a few days either. They seem to know that the king is not interested in just another woman from his collection. Truth is, he could have had any woman he wanted at any time he wanted, because he was the king and he had quite a collection of them. He had a waiting supply. How you like that, ladies? You're just a member of a supply of women for the king. How's that make you feel? I told you this chapter's ugly. His servants, though, they want to seek the most beautiful woman, not just from the capital, but from all 127 provinces in his kingdom. So finally, in chapter 2, we arrive at the woman of the month. This is Women's History Month still, right? We've seen so far that all these things have been happening under the supervision of the one who is never mentioned in the text. Now we meet two more people that God has already known about and already is planning to use. Look at chapter 2, verse 5. Now in Shushan the palace, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who, that would be Kish, the nearest antecedent, had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity which had been carried away when Jeconiah, the king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And he brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter. So his uncle would have been Jair's brother, for she had neither father nor mother, and the maid was fair and beautiful, whom Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took for his own daughter. So Mordecai and Hadassah, Esther, are cousins, first cousins. Your uncle's children are your cousins, and that's what Esther is. Look at verse 8. So it came to pass when the king's commandment and his decree was heard, and when many maidens were gathered together unto Shushan the palace to the custody of Haggai, that Esther was brought also unto the king's house to the custody of Haggai, keeper of the women. And the maiden pleased him, Haggai, and she obtained kindness of him. And he speedily gave her her things for purification. There's that word. With such things as belonged to her and the seven maidens, which were meet to be given her out of the king's house. And he, Haggai, preferred her and her maids unto the best place in the house of the women. Esther had not showed her people nor her kindred, for Mordecai had charged her that she should not show it. And Mordecai walked every day before the court of the women's house to know how Esther did and what should become of her. Well, there's quite a bit in there. So let's narrow it down. We have Mordecai and Esther and eventually Haggai, who will prove to be very beneficial to Esther. The phrase, a certain Jew, That's another phrase that you see in the Bible. A certain man, a certain woman, a certain Jew. Tells us that Mordecai is nobody special in and of his own right. I read while doing some research that some suspect that because his great-great-great-grandfather Kish was in the first deportation, that there may have been some royalty in Mordecai, may or may not have been. He may have been connected. I don't know. Text doesn't tell us. That's kind of speculation. A certain Jew. He is merely a fourth-generation Jewish Persian-born man who has never seen the Promised Land. He's never been there. He's nobody special from a human perspective. But never forget who's arranging everything here. God is. His name, Mordecai, literally means little man. Can also mean worshiper of Mars, but I don't think that applies here. He is raising his cousin, probably significantly younger than him, because he had the ability to be responsible to raise her on the death of her mother and father. Hadassah, her Hebrew name, Esther, a Persian name, is a maid who is both fair and beautiful. The NASB translates that expression, was beautiful of form and face. Her Hebrew name, Hadassah, means myrtle or fragrant flowering bush, while her Persian name, Esther, means star. I'll tell you what, don't listen, honey, I think I'd really like this girl. I love the crepe myrtles that bloom. They do smell good. You go up and smell crepe myrtle. I have no foggy idea why my bees do not like crepe myrtles, because we have tons of them. And I love to go out in the stars at night and stare up at them. They amaze me. I've been known to go out and check the mailbox, even after dark, knowing there's nothing in it, just so I can do this. I do. So these two people, an older and a younger cousin, are about to be used by God in a nearly unbelievable way. Not only has he chosen two relatively normal Jews, but he's going to use this Persian keeper of the women to provide for Esther in a very special way. Look at verse 8. It came to pass, I'm going to read it again because, there's so many things here. When the king's commandment and his decree were heard, that many maidens were gathered together unto Shushan the palace to the custody of Haggai, that Esther was brought also to the king's house. And the maiden pleased him. She obtained kindness of him. He speedily gave her her things for purification with such things as belonged to her and seven maidens. So he gives her seven maidens, which were fitting meat to be given to her out of the king's house. So he had all these extra maidens. I'm telling you. The way men treat women in here, it's not pretty. Here we are in the midst of a beauty contest, and we've got all this mistreatment of women, which is not pretty. He preferred her and her maids unto the best place, so he put them in the best place in the house. This is the pre-pageant pageant, if you will. All these beautiful women arrive at Shushan. They're placed in the custody of the palace eunuch. And that's exactly what Haggai's name means. And it only means that. It doesn't mean anything else. He's the keeper of the women. Now, if you are a typical non-faith thinking person, which it seems Mordecai and Esther probably are, I would suppose you'd think that things are really going well in your plan, wouldn't you? Esther gets word to Mordecai, hey, this guy likes me. And he's fixed me up with the seven best maids he could find, and he put me in the best place in the house here. Things are going good, Uncle Mordecai. Cousin Mordecai. I know. This Haggai fellow has taken a special interest in her. He appears to be giving her special treatment, extra care. Kind of like Joseph in prison. You know? Yep, things are looking good. However, look at the last statement in verse 10. Esther had not showed her people nor her kindred, for Mordecai had told her that she should not do it. There's more here than is spoken or written, if you want. Throughout history, most people have never had much of a problem identifying Jewish people. So, how or why is it that the citizens in Shushan did not already identify these two as Jews? How enculturated into that, how indoctrinated, how whatever, into that culture had these two people become? How far from the worship of the one true God had these two people fallen that he could pull this off and no one would know? In fact, why were these two even still living in Persia? Shouldn't they have been back in Israel by now? Turn back a few pages to Ezra chapter 1. It's interesting where the placement of Esther is in your Bible. What we have? Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. Right? Ezra chapter 1, now in the first year of Cyrus, the king of Persia, same kingdom, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, the king of Persia, that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, that's all 127 provinces, and he put it also in writing, saying, thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord God of heaven has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. That's 538 B.C., that's the recognized date of the first return from Babylon to Jerusalem. That's the event, when you read it in Ezra, where a mere 50,000 and a few more left the captivity and went back to the promised land. Why is there still a highly significant number of God's people still living in Persia? In Shushan in the year 479, some 59 years later. Why are they still there? Might I suggest disobedience to God? Comfortable living? Familiarity? Laziness? Lack of interest? Or whatever other human trait you might think of? The other thing not written is that the sovereign God is using Haggai to bless Esther. And again, even though he's not mentioned, he is not inactive in his plan. We have time tonight, so one more paragraph, because this is really exciting, right? Look at verse 12. Chapter 2, verse 12. Now when every maid's turn was come to go into King Ahasuerus, after that she had been 12 months, according to the manner of women, for so were the days of their purifications accomplished, to wit, 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 months with sweet odors, and with other things for the purifying of the women. There's your word twice, purifications and purifying. You're remembering that word, aren't you? I'm going to tell you why next week. Then thus came every maiden unto the king. Whatsoever she desired was given her to go with her out of the house of the women unto the king's house. In the evening she went, and on the morrow, that's the next day, she returned into the second house of the women to the custody of Shazgaz, the king's chamberlain, which kept the concubines. She came in unto the king no more, except the king delighted in her, and that she were called by name. We learn another very interesting fact about how they took their time and everything. Maybe I should say in the process. After she had been 12 months, the text says, all the women, 12 months, according to the manner of women, 6 months oil of myrrh, 6 months sweet odors, and then other things as well. Ladies, wouldn't you like to be spoiled like that? Okay, the word purification. The word translated twice in that verse, in verse 12, purification or purifying, same word. It's the same word that's back in verse 9 that I pointed out when we read that. Literally means to rub or scrape. Still want to do it, ladies? C.F. Kyle of Kyle and Delitzsch said the word means to rub, to polish, signifies purification and adornment with all kinds of precious ointments. So if you read verse 9 this way, he speedily gave her her things for rubbing and polishing. It would give us men a better appreciation of ladies applying their makeup, wouldn't it? Well, is mom ready to go? No, she's rubbing and polishing. Okay. Seriously, the word is meant to apply to the scrubbing of the dirt out of a wound, the cleaning of it, the skinned knee that cuts right through the jeans and leaves a big raspberry, we used to call it. You slide into second base, you get a raspberry on your hip, and it hurts for a week. Done there, been there, done that, right? And then the rubbing of the ointment in to help it to heal, to keep it from getting infected. And seriously, we have all seen our wives rub, what do you call that first stuff? Foundation? You know, you put a little dab here and here and here and here, and then they rub it in, right? Moisturizer first, then whatever. You want to come do this? That's what the word means. A full 12 months of rubbing and polishing, I suppose. Nothing's too good for the king, right? And we thought prep for Miss America was extreme. So one of my questions would be, why would older cousin Mordecai ask Esther to do this? Follow-up question, why would she agree to it? Another question might be, where is God in their decision-making to enter this beauty pageant of a pagan king? Well, the truth appears to be, they didn't ask anyone for advice, least of all, God. Have you ever considered, what if Esther had not won? And you all are going, well, we know she did, it's in the Bible. But what if she hadn't won? You know, she'd simply be another beautiful woman for the rest of her life in the king's harem. But before we finish, let's see one more thing. Look at verse 13. Then thus came every maiden unto the king. Whatsoever she desired was given her to go in with her out of the house of the women unto the king's house. In the evening she went, and on the morrow she returned into the second house of the women to the custody of Shaazgaz, the king's chamberlain, who kept the concubines. She came in unto the king no more, except the king delighted in her, and she were called by name. So we have seen each woman literally spend a year rubbing and polishing, 6 months with oil of myrrh, 6 months with sweet odors, and with other things. Now when their time has come on an individual basis, they are allowed to choose their garments, whatever they want to take with them. They leave this house of the women where they have been sequestered all this time, and they go to the king's house. In a way, it's somewhat amazing to me that they didn't all go at once and the king would do like a modern beauty pageant and compare them and say, I like that one, you're the winner. How do I say this? That might have been maybe a little more understandable to our brains. But instead, this pagan culture allows the king to, pardon the expression, sample every contestant. And to me, that is ugly. For years, I have heard well-meaning people, well-meaning Christians, talk about this event in some kind of a humorous or light way. I've probably done it. But I don't really see anything humorous about it. This is worse than any 21st century beauty pageant you could have ever imagined. This pagan king violates each and every woman. And if he decides he doesn't quite like this one, she doesn't fill his expectations, off she goes to the second house of the women, where she remains until he might someday call for her, if he can remember her name. Here it is, black and white. In the evening she went, and on the morrow she returned to the second house of the women, into the custody of Shaazgaz, where he kept the concubines. Shaazgaz's name, by the way, means servant of the beautiful. Well, there weren't any ugly women in that house. They wouldn't have got past Haggai in the first place. This practice is a matter of historical record. Dr. Whitcomb points it out in his commentary on Esther. This is what Mordecai sent his younger cousin to participate in, this abuse of women. This is what Esther agreed to do. And this is all before there was any knowledge of the very real threat that is going to be posed by the next character we're going to meet, the wicked guy named Haman. No wonder God did not allow his name to be associated with all this. But he's still there, superintending over the affairs of men. Pagan king, pagan keeper of the women, pagan keeper of the concubines. He is still superintending then and now, right now. Even though the remnant had already returned 50-some years earlier, God was still going to be faithful to his chosen people who didn't go back. This larger number, actually, that remained who did not go back in the returns. People spread all throughout the 127 provinces, quite honestly, because when we get to the end of the book of Esther, we find out that Mordecai drafts the law which allows the Jews to defend themselves from the attacks, and it has to be sent by swift rider to all 127 provinces. So they were everywhere. Come to think of it, isn't God preserving both his holy name, his reputation, and his chosen people throughout the entire account? Yeah. This same God who did this for his wayward Jews, of which, in my brain, Esther and Mordecai are extremely wayward Jews. I've also experienced, and you probably have too, a number of people who preached this passage and said, oh, Esther was so godly, she did this, she deferred to her older cousin. I don't see it. I'm sorry. Not knowing what they were engaging in. And there was no reason for them to engage in it. Humanly speaking, they didn't know about Haman or what he was doing or what he wanted. They didn't know that. That has not come up yet. This same God can and does preserve us through whatever situations or circumstances we manage to get ourselves into too. What a great and amazing God we serve. Father, thank you for our time in Esther tonight.